This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's Friday. It's time for our weekend review on the nation's and Commonwealth's minds. Afghanistan, the deadly attack at Kabul's airport, and the messy U.S. withdrawal.
America will not be intimidated. And I have the utmost confidence in our brave service members who continue to execute this mission with courage and honor to save lives and get Americans, our partners, our Afghan allies out of Afghanistan.
This comes after Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton made a surprise covert visit to Kabul earlier this week, angering party leadership.
They have to make their own case as to why they went and this or that, but it was not, in my view, a good idea.
Moulton defended the trip on CNN's Chris Cuomo.
When I saw a picture of them on the base, it was this heroic Afghan journalist, his wife and two little girls, just about the same age as mine, I knew it was worth it. And if I could get on a plane to figure out how to save a few more families, then I'm sorry, Chris, I'm going to do that.
Those lost in the political shuffle, those left behind. Here's Syed, resettled in Massachusetts through the special immigrant visa program in May 2019. He still has family in Afghanistan.
I'm sure they're going to show their real face, and I'm afraid of that. All those things that they did in 25 years ago, they do it again. I believe these are the same Talibans.
Lots to get to. So let's dive right in with our guests. Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor and now CEO of Verdant Medical, a cannabis company. And Richard Tessay, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts Senate and a former Republican candidate for Congress. Tito, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Richard, welcome back to you as well.
Nice to talk to you again.
And listeners, weigh in. What's on your mind about Afghanistan, these attacks, the move by Congressman Seth Moulton, the withdrawal? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tito, Richard, we've got a foreshortened weekend review today. Our show was preempted by Afghanistan coverage, as a matter of fact, yesterday. We want to bring listeners two fascinating and timely conversations we had. We're going to do that later in the show. But now let's dive in this shortened weekend review. It feels like we really should start with a moment of solidarity with those yet on the ground in Kabul, those who newly experienced injury and loss yesterday. New death toll numbers, 13 U.S. troops, 170 others, at least 200 wounded. Richard, how are you feeling and what are you hearing in your community?
You know, I had a hard time sleeping last night. I'm sure a lot of other people have too. And you know, you look at the situation on the ground and what's happening, and then you look at the bigger picture. You know, September 11th, that was going to be the 20th anniversary of 9/11. And, you know, this, you know, we're going to deal with that anniversary, and a lot of people are going to have, you know, a lot of time of reflection here. But there's going to be a split screen on the TV because in Kabul, they're going to be celebrating that the very people who attacked us 20 years ago have taken over the country. And, you know, it's just, I think for a lot of people, you know, we lost a lot of people in 9/11 from the Boston area, people that I know. It's just, you got to ask yourself, what was the last 20 years all about? We didn't have a terrorist attack during that period of time. But what's going to happen over the next 5 and 10 years now that, you know, now that we've got to the point where it looks like the terrorists have won and we're in retreat, and it's pretty humiliating for the United States. Nobody wanted to stay there, but, you know, the way we've left has been a major problem, and it's going to lead to a lot of deaths, unfortunately.
So, Richard, I know that you meant we didn't have a foreign terrorist attack during that time, because, of course, the Marathon bombing.
Exactly.
And, you know, Tito, what Richard said really resonates with me specifically. Richard started by saying he had a hard time sleeping last night. When we had Syed on earlier this week, and we're not using his last name for the safety of his family that's still in Afghanistan, I asked him if he was sleeping, and he said, I'm sleeping, but that sleep is full of nightmares. How are you feeling today, and what are you hearing from people?
Very somber. This is really a failure and a stain on the connection and relationship that not only we have with Afghanistan and the Afghani people, but also with our standing in the world. And so I think this is not to be underplayed in terms of the fact that, yes, I'm a Democrat, and yes, I stand in support of the troops that are there and on the ground, and all of the servicemen and women there. But I do believe this was an error in leadership by our president and the manner in which this occurred. To have military evacuating before we had all of our civilians out, and knowing the prior administration's stonewalling, and there's been multiple stories this week about Stephen Miller going off on racist tirades about the SIV program, which is a program that would allow Afghanis to come into the country.
Stephen Miller, just Stephen Miller being a former advisor to President Trump.
Yes. Him basically blocking, slowing that program down for the Biden administration to do this and try to do it so quickly, to not start in June rather than starting in August, is very, very problematic. And my heart goes out to not only those 13 service members, families of Americans, but the over 170 and climbing the number of Afghanis who've passed away. We have to step up and do the right thing.
So, Tito, you're sort of sounding some of the criticism that we heard from Congressman Seth Moulton, and I want to dive into that. We do have a caller who does, too. So I think let's start with Barbara in Wakefield and give her the first word on this. Barbara, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just think that Seth Moulton just shouldn't have, just jumped on a plane and headed down there. I think he should really stand with the president. Everybody's an armchair quarterback here. And, I think the president's doing the best he can. Easy to criticize, sitting back here, what he's done. And I just think it's terrible that Seth Moulton, went there. And, you know, he should stand with the party and stand with our leader.
Thanks.
I just think it's unfortunate.
Thank you for that, Barbara. And let me put that number out for folks, 1-800-423-8255. Do you agree with Barbara? Or do you think Moulton should have made the trip? So, Richard, I'll turn to you. There are two themes coming out here. One is Moulton's choice. The other is, do you stand by the president? Do you agree or disagree with him? I want to get to both, but let's just start with Moulton's choice, right? So he and Republican congressman from Michigan, Peter Meyer, both veterans of the Iraq War, both former Marines, slip into Afghanistan unannounced. Don't tell the president first. Don't tell the administration. They say that they were there to provide oversight. It has certainly sent shockwaves through the country. I know you ran against Moulton in 2014. So let's start with your reaction.
I was going to say full disclosure.
Yeah.
I get along with Seth. And I would say I look at both sides of the ledger. First of all, that caller who just called in. No, you don't put your party first right now. You put your country first. And I'll give Seth a lot of credit for, saying what, being honest, for the country and saying that this pullout has been a disaster, no matter how you look at it. And there are a lot of congressmen who are afraid to, say what's right, what we all can see. But he did stand up and he did, and he didn't just do it right now. He's been leading the charge to get the visa requirements changed so more people who helped us can get out of the country. So I would start off by saying that. But I agree that, his decision to just jump on a plane and, go to Afghanistan just added another unneeded layer, of confusion. I can only imagine what the pandemonium that was taking place at the airport for the officials there to, have to deal with, two congressmen who just show up, I know a lot of people look at it as a political stunt and, it just not good. There were, a lot of people were trying to save lives. And so I look at it both ways. I appreciate the fact that he's being honest and that he's, leading the charge. There are a lot of people in the military in high positions that need to resign as a result of this debacle. Our be held to account for what they did. I know Tito mentioned, you know, some of the things, but leaving $80 billion worth of equipment there, allowing the airport to be surrounded, handing a list to the Taliban, which Politico reported yesterday, of people who have helped us in Afghanistan, and Americans who were coming to the airport. You know, if you didn't make it, you're dead. The Taliban have all your information. They know that you've been working with us. You know, it was like a kill list. So whoever's making those decisions, I'm not sure. I don't even think it's the president. Whoever's making those decisions has to be held to account.
So,
I give Seth a lot of credit.
I'm going to pick up on that thread, Richard. So Wednesday, while it's not clear if Moulton was literally still in transit on the way back, but, you know, he was traveling back on Wednesday, we spoke with David Gergen, former White House advisor to Presidents Nixon, Ford, Reagan, Clinton, founding director of the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School, and he was a mentor of Moulton's when Moulton was at Harvard. Tito, here's what he said.
Seth believed very strongly, as do every other veteran I've ever talked to about this, believes very strongly we should not leave people behind. It's a matter of honor. It's a matter of moral commitment. And we shouldn't do it.
Which, Tito, raised an interesting question for me about one's personal commitment, one's moral commitment, and one's responsibilities as an elected leader. And did they come into conflict here? Do you understand what I'm asking?
I do. And in this case, and I have to give props where props are due to those individuals who are elected leaders who have actually served in our armed services, as well as the fact he served in the theater of war. So first, we have to start there. I have not, and most elected officials in the United States have not. I believe in this case, and I am one of those individuals who, when I was an elected official, I showed up at crime scenes, I showed up at fires, and the like. I do believe this is a little bit more complex, because the one component here is that we know that Congress people are going to receive heightened levels of security on the ground. And that security would have to come from a limited number of people as the drawdown has occurred. But I also do believe there are things to be learned from physically being in a space and place, in particular those individuals who have been there in the past. And frankly, you know, this mentality again, I'm a Democrat, and this the commander in chief, and I don't blame generals or servicemen and women. This actually rolls up to the ultimate figure, the commander in chief. This is not a question of whether or not we should have left, but it's how we should have left. And I absolutely believe that we should not have left folks behind. And in addition, we are now making our work over the past 20 years and our world much less safe by these actions. A
couple of calls from constituents of Seth Moulton. I'd like to grab one of those. We've got Marta on the line from Marblehead. Marta, go ahead.
Hello. I think we need to get as many people out as we can. I think we have an obligation to get all Americans out. I think that Seth Moulton's decision to go over and use resources on his own personal agenda, thinking that he could make a big difference, I think it took resources and extra care and personnel away from the rescue effort that is being made. It has nothing to do with the president's decision or a decision to how or when to leave. It has to do with using up resources.
Thank you for that. Thank you for that, Marta. So, Richard, I'm going to pivot a little from Marta, because we've talked about resources now. We've talked about the congressman's decision, public leadership. The other thing that is striking about this, Tito talked a moment ago about how few elected officials have served. We have two in the congressional delegation, because we also have Jake Auchincloss, also a former Marine who served in Afghanistan. And he has taken a different attitude towards the Biden administration than Moulton has. Here he is on CNN, and here he's describing how he thinks the U.S. should move forward in extracting the remaining folks from Afghanistan.
Now that evacuations are substantially advanced, we should transition that program to one that uses diplomatic channels to get remaining Afghan allies out after August 31st.
So what strikes me here, I mean, there are many things that are striking, but one thing that strikes me here is he has much more supported President Biden. Seth Moulton's been very critical of President Biden on the timing of all of this. What does it say that two Democrats, both of whom identify as progressives, they've also taken swipes from the left, but identify as progressives, with military service in a super democratic state like Massachusetts, can so profoundly disagree about policy on a subject like this? What does it say? Is it a mirror of America, a sign of how hard the problem is?
Well, I think that Seth is the exception rather than the rule. And I think a lot of the congressmen, you know, look at it as a political thing and can't get to the higher level for, the, you know, looking at it for the country. There haven't been, the reason why he's attracted so much attention, even before he went on this trip, was because he was one of the only people who were speaking out, you know, about the missteps. And, you know, it's funny because this is one of the few things in our lifetime that everybody is watching, you know, and everybody's seeing it for themselves. So when Nancy Pelosi gets up and says, oh, the president's doing a great job, you know, it, and I'm not even saying this politically, but people see, you know, they see every day what's going on there and just the mistakes and the missteps. And again, I don't think the president knows what's going on. I blame the senior military and the people inside the White House who are making these decisions. So, you know, our country's in a lot of trouble right now, and I think we have to stop fighting about pronouns and political correctness and all this stuff and recognize that we are in a very dangerous world. We've had 20 years where, you know, we haven't had to, we could sleep a little easier at night, you know, knowing that we were safer. What we have unleashed right now, this is going to go on for, you know, some things happen, you go through decades where nothing significant happens, and then sometimes you go through a week where things happen that change the next 100 years. Mm. And that's what this week is. I mean, what is it has been unleashed this week is going to have a lot of repercussions for our country and for people for a long time.
All right, let's grab one more call here. We've got Ralph in Arlington. Ralph, go ahead. Briefly, Ralph.
Okay, I support Seth Moulton's trip. He serves as an additional eyewitness, and that's important because President Biden has made some incorrect statements, several of them, one of which was that about 4 days ago said that no Americans had been harassed or prevented by the Taliban from getting to the airport. You know, that's not true. Some of them have been beaten. Many were turned away several times before they were able to get through.
Ralph, thanks for that. So that oversight, which is a part of the argument that Seth Moulton has made, Tito. So, Tito, we are on a short time frame here, and I want to come all the way back to the beginning because there is one other piece of this. Syed and the others here in the Commonwealth who are watching their family members at home, and they're hurting. They're really hurting. What do we as a community need to do for our brothers and sisters who are hurting in this moment?
I think one of the most important things that we have to do is to make sure that we have the housing, the services, and the resources for those individuals who need to come to the U.S. I also believe that it's absolutely critical that we look at this not in a vacuum, and that this has a lot to do. And this is the part that I am critical of my president on, is using the Trump time frame after Pompeo playing footsie with folks and making the assumption that this is a kinder, gentler Taliban. I think we also have to look at this in the macro perspective as in terms of whether or not we have or will be perceived as good partners, and whether places like China or Russia will be perceived as even more consistent partners.
All right,
but we have to deal with the people, people's needs who are coming here in a thoughtful manner.
For this week, we'll leave it there. Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor and now CEO of Verdant Medical. Richard Tessay, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts State Senate and a former Republican candidate for Congress. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
As we mentioned, WBUR preempted yesterday's show to bring you important live coverage of the attack in Kabul. Today, we're bringing you two unmissable conversations from that show. We will bring you the third next week. First up, another perspective on Worcester's St. Vincent Hospital. Nearly 700 nurses there still striking after nearly 6 months. Tenet Healthcare, which owns St. Vincent, made a final contract offer earlier this month, which the striking nurses tentatively accepted. But while the hospital will welcome all the nurses back, approximately 100 will not be able to return to their old jobs. The hospital is keeping replacement nurses that it hired, and that's a deal breaker for the striking nurses, so the walkout continues. On Wednesday, we brought you one of the striking nurses, so now Carolyn Jackson, St. Vincent's CEO. And we began with this: nearly 700 nurses still on strike, approaching 6 months during staffing shortages and a pandemic. How did we get here?
Well, first of all, there's only about 650 nurses who are still on strike because of the number who have crossed the picket line. And we got here because of the irresponsible actions of the MNA. The strike was based on a false premise.
MNA being Massachusetts Nurses Association?
Yes, Massachusetts Nurses Association, yes. And the strike was based on a false premise. They said we had poor staffing. And we've proven three ways: our own analysis that was validated by an external third party, the statewide database, Patient Care Link, that had us in the 74th percentile of hospitals of our size for nurse staffing. And then most recently, U.S. News and World Report, that ranked us in the top 10 in Massachusetts and also gave us the highest possible rating for nurse staffing, tied only with Mass General, Brigham and Women's, and Tufts in Massachusetts. So our staffing pre-strike was excellent, and they struck over a false pretense in order to try to get a 4-to-1 nurse to patient or patient to nurse ratio. And they have continued that strike. And as we said, it's irresponsible of them to strike in a pandemic. And we now have agreement on almost all the terms of our last, best, and final offer and are trying to negotiate a return to work agreement.
So there are a bunch of things I want to unpack in what you just said. And the first, I don't mean to sound glib, but in most things it takes two to tango. You are putting all the responsibility on the nurses here. The hospital has been engaged in this back and forth for 6 months as well. Do you see any responsibility on the hospital side for this going on so long during a public health crisis?
We put an excellent offer on the table pre-strike that they rejected, and we have bargained in good faith since before the strike. And in the summer, the nurses said they were going to be out until after Labor Day, which appears to prove to be true. So we did take the action to hire permanent replacement nurses in order to stabilize our workforce, and that's currently the bone of contention.
Okay, so you talked about the ranking from U.S. Nurses and World Report. It was their 2021-2022 ranking, put St. Vincent's ninth in Massachusetts. The nurses have said, Marie Rotaco said on the show yesterday, that there were increased falls, bed sores, and other incidents prior to the strike. Were the nurses not telling the truth? I mean, they are talking about an increase in incidences. That's a measurable thing. Were there increases in these incidences?
There are not. They have no data to support. We have continued to provide data to support our quality and our staffing, and they have not been able to provide any data that supports their points.
All right. So then we also talked about this 1-to-4 ratio, and I want to pull this out a little bit. In a statement to WBUR's Adrian Ma, Tenet Healthcare said that St. Vincent staffing ratios are on par with other hospitals. In that statement, the two examples were MGH and Tufts Medical Center. But we know there are some hospitals that use the 1-to-4 ratio that the nurses wanted in the contract. Massachusetts Nurses Association has cited UMass Memorial Lawrence General Hospital as two examples. What is your concern with a ratio at all and with the 1-to-4 ratio desired by the nurses as this thing unfolded?
So, again, I will say it is not true that Mass General and Lowell General have 1-to-4 ratios across the board in MedSurg.
No. I said UMass Memorial and Lawrence General.
General. Thank you. But again, yeah. I've spoken with leadership specifically at UMass, and they've said we absolutely do not have a 1-to-4 ratio across the board. We have it in some units. At night, their staffing is different. The staffing in our proposal that they have accepted is one of the best, if not the best, staffing contracts in the state. Our contract has had grids and ratios in the contract since 2,000. We're one of only about five hospitals in Massachusetts that actually has ratios in its collective bargaining agreement. So we have a much more tight staffing requirement. And in fact, when we looked both pre-pandemic and during the pandemic, there were very few instances where we were actually out of compliance with the staffing that had been in our contract before, that again is actually quite good when compared with others in the state. And we made it even better with the language that they've agreed to in this current contract that we're negotiating.
Okay, so switching gears, did you know the nurses would be caught off guard when they accepted the final last, I think you guys called it the final last best offer, that they would not be able to return to their original jobs? Did you anticipate that that would be a surprise to the nurses? It seems like it would be.
I don't think it should have been a surprise. We had made statements that we were not going to remove our permanent replacement nurses. And we told them, we were very clear in May that we were hiring permanent replacement nurses to stabilize our workforce. And so they struck for 2 months without us replacing anyone. And then for the last 3 months, we've been hiring. So it should not have come as a surprise to them.
So what's the blueprint to getting people back to work and ending this now, Carolyn?
So we have put what we consider a very fair and generous return to work agreement on the table. First and foremost, it includes an anti-bullying, anti-discrimination, anti-harassment clause to make sure that those who cross the picket line are safe from those things, as well as the striking nurses are safe from those things. We also have a clause that any nurse who was on strike who wants to come back to work at St. Vincent will have a job. It may not be the job that that person left pre-strike, but everybody will have a job. If they don't want the job that might be available to them, we have offered some superior bidding rights that would allow them to bid into jobs as they become open. And we've also put a severance package on the table for people who don't want either of those options. So we've been very, very flexible and I think very generous with the offer, given that we do have people who we are unwilling to remove forcibly from their positions.
So are there situations where somebody who you have hired is less experienced than a nurse who can't come back into the old job, and how to address that concern if it's the case from a patient care perspective?
That may be possible in some cases. Anybody who has been hired who is in need of orientation is getting that orientation. We had a number of new-to-practice nurses who went on strike. We had nurses everywhere from no tenure to 40 years tenure who went on strike. And we have nurses of a varying set of experiences who we've hired in permanent replacement.
All right. If any of the striking nurses are listening, Carolyn, briefly, last question to you. What would you want them to hear from you today?
I would want them to hear that if they want to come back to work at St. Vincent Hospital, we will welcome them back, whether it is as a crosser now or whether it is as a striking nurse returning when the contract is ratified. And if their position is one that has been replaced, we will work with them as closely as possible to find the best possible outcome for them, and that we appreciate all the contributions they've made to patient care in the past.
All right. That is Carolyn Jackson, CEO of St. Vincent Hospital. Appreciate you appearing on Radio Boston. Thanks.
Thank you.
Now, the latest in our conversations with the major candidates for Boston mayor. Next up, Acting Mayor Kim Janey. A new Emerson College poll shows Janey trailing Boston City Councilors Michelle Wu and Anissa Asaibi George, but with a margin of error and enough undecided voters to keep things unpredictable. When Janey joined us yesterday, I began by asking her a question we've asked the other candidates so far. In a historic election, why is she the right person to lead this city in this moment?
Experience. I am leading our city as the 55th mayor, as the first woman mayor, as the first black mayor, with my own lived experience, with my professional experience, informing how I lead and how I govern. From day one, stepped in during a time of unprecedented challenges, making sure that we were prioritizing the people of Boston, dealing with a pandemic, multiple challenges and scandals with our police department, bringing our children back into the classrooms in the spring, again this fall, reopening our city, leading from day one, leadership and experience. I bring to this race, obviously, a life experience that is different than all of my predecessors, and it is a lens of equity, of justice, and love. I understand as an advocate, as someone who has 30 years plus experience in the nonprofit world, including nonprofit management, the importance of advocacy. That is what I have done throughout my career. I bring that same advocacy and urgency because now is a moment that we cannot squander. We have to make sure we're doing everything to bring all of our residents together to meet this moment, to make sure that our goal isn't to go back to normal, but to go better, to make sure creating a stronger Boston and a Boston that is more equitable, just, and resilient.
I'm going to jump in right there for a second on equity, resilience, justice. One of the things that is striking about this race is that it is a race full of historic candidates who have lived experiences of income inequality, racism, family interactions with law enforcement as just a few examples. So many candidates with lived experience that connect them with the profound equity and justice issues of the city. What in your lived experience, which is a term you used in your previous answer, is different in a way that makes you more qualified? And I mean your past lived experience. I understand the delineation of being the mayor right now.
Well, I'm going to start with that. I am the only person in this race who has experience leading a major urban city, not just leading the city, but through unprecedented challenges, whether COVID-19 or the income inequality and the racial wealth gap that it helps to create, or the challenges in our schools with our economy. I'm the only one who has experience leading a city of 18,000 employees, close to 700,000 residents with a $3.75 billion budget, which I successfully passed only weeks after being in office with a decisive vote. So we can start there. In terms of my lived experience, my professional experience, it's the nonprofit world, 30 years, of advocacy, putting forth policies that lift up children and make sure we are promoting equity in our schools. It is my own lived experience having overcome a number of challenges, whether that be going to Boston Public Schools and being bused at 11 years old during the battle to desegregate Boston Public Schools, whether my experience as a young single mom on Section 8 and making sure I could give my daughter every opportunity despite living in poverty, despite, the conditions that were around us, housing insecurity, spending time in shelter.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
And bringing all of those experiences to this role as mayor.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I appreciate that answer. There are a bunch of things I have to get through with you, so I'm going to pick up now on some of the policy stuff. You are running from the mayor's seat, which means you are the one, no pun intended, calling the shots on COVID. And over the last few weeks, you've created some mandates. Indoor mask mandate last week, mask mandates for schools in July. You announced a vaccine mandate for city workers earlier this month. As an observer, it is hard to get a sense of whether you believe the power of the mayor should be used this way, should be used this way reluctantly, should be avoided wherever possible. We'll be having public health conversations for, it seems like, always now. So as someone who wants a full term in office, what is the proper role of the mayor in mandating public health behavior?
The role of the mayor is to lead the city, to make sure we are doing everything possible to protect our residents. That is what I've done, and that is why close to 70% of residents across Boston have at least one shot in their arm. That didn't happen by accident. That happened by my leadership. Since I've been mayor, there's been a 40% increase in the number of vaccines. We have
seen increases
across.
Yes, but that is not mandate. That's encouragement. That's carrots and sticks.
We have seen increases along racial lines and across every neighborhood. The importance, this is a global pandemic. And first and foremost, is protecting and prioritizing the people of my city. That is what I have done as mayor through a number of initiatives, including prioritizing vaccine access and information, as well as the mask mandate, and everything that we have done from day one, always being informed by the data, always keeping the people of Boston first and foremost.
Okay, so you have been criticized by some of your rivals for not moving fast enough on public health measures. I know you're aware that Counselors Michelle Wu and Andrea Campbell are advocating for proof of vaccination status, essentially a requirement to show you're fully vaccinated to access places with large numbers of people. You have not supported the idea. Why?
My leadership has led to the city of Boston being one of the most vaccinated big cities in the country. Again, 70% of Boston residents have at least one shot in the arm. Just in the last 3 weeks alone, 12,000 residents got vaccinated. That is the work that I am doing as mayor, and I will continue to prioritize the people of Boston and not politicize the pandemic.
So your concern is that those kinds of steps are politicizing?
I will continue to prioritize the people of Boston. I will continue to focus on getting vaccinations into people's arms, making sure that we are slowing the spread, that we are getting information out, that we are meeting people where they are, making sure that everyone can make informed decisions about the vaccine as we continue to live with COVID-19.
So let's move on to policing, which is an area you've spoken about a lot. You came into a challenging situation with Commissioner Dennis White, who you chose to fire. One of the hallmarks of police reform, as we discuss police reform policy at the national level, the state level, the local level, is transparency. I want to stay in the candidate lane here, also acknowledging that there have been back and forth with you, with other candidates, with the Attorney General in your role as acting mayor around transparency in the Boston Police Department. As a candidate running for a full term of mayor, what is the transparency imperative in police reform, and what steps must one take to get there?
I have done already, in just weeks of being mayor, more to ensure transparency and accountability than anyone before me. That is unrefuted. We will continue to lead on transparency, making sure we are releasing files of our police, making sure that we continue to build up the Office of Police Accountability and Transparency, that we are also reimagining policing in our city. One,
tell me what that means. Talk a little more about that reimagining.
We have to do much more around community policing, which also means we have to reimagine how we respond to crisis. I have put forth an initiative of a mental health response that looks at co-response, alternative response, and community response, particularly as it relates to mental health crises. If we have someone who is having difficulty due to an episode around mental health, we need to make sure that there are experts on the ground who can be there as a first responder, who can help, who can assist, who has expertise in this field. That is why we put that initiative forth. I launched that just a couple of weeks ago. And we want to make sure, again, that we are responding appropriately when it comes to public health, so that our police officers can focus on public safety, so that they are free to focus on the most violent crimes in our city. And so that is part of how we reimagine policing. We also need, you know, more diversity, which is why I've increased our cadet program by 50% in the FY22 budget. It's why we've invested in racial equity training for our police officers. We know that Boston police officers work hard. We know that people all across our city do, but we also know wherever we have challenges, we've got to meet the moment, make sure we're supporting our workforce, and that we're moving toward safety, justice, and healing in every single neighborhood.
So I'm going to take advantage of this opportunity to ask you another question, because that the siren sound in the background is starting to get really loud anyway. And I do need to change gears for us, because I want to spend a minute before we let you go.
I'm glad.
Yeah. That is the reality of the moment. I totally get it.
There you go. Particularly, listen, we're talking public safety, right?
That's right. That's right.
Goes by an ambulance.
There you go.
By. Yes.
So let's talk about one other aspect here, which is homelessness and addiction, the area around Mass and Cass. Conditions in the area have gotten, by all accounts, worse over the past year. It's a major topic in the race. What are you working on about it now, and what is your plan to do for Mass and Cass if you are elected to a full four-year term?
Yes, this is a very difficult situation that has been years in the making, and we know that COVID, like so many with so many other issues, has made this particular challenge worse. And our team continues to do work on the ground, not just cleaning the area, but making sure that there is a public health response. In the last week alone, 55 individuals were referred to treatment. And that is the good news. And we are getting more and more folks connected to services, which is the good news. But we've got to revamp our approach, starting with the task force, making sure that we are doing more with the courts. We had a great meeting, one of many, with the DA's office around a coordinated response and approach to this challenge. Too much of it has all been left to the city of Boston. We know that history. When the bridge came down, 7 years ago. And we need not only to have a coordinated approach between agencies here in our city, but with municipalities across the region. Addiction knows no boundaries. I know many of us have had experiences in our own family. That certainly is true of myself. Unfortunately, when I was a teenager, a young adult, I lost my uncle to an overdose. He was found dead with a needle in his arm. And we've learned a lot since that time, that this is a public health crisis, and that we've got to respond accordingly.
So last question for you on this. Victory Programs had planned to lease the vacant Best Western Hotel in the area, provide beds and transitional housing. The city wasn't even going to provide some of the funding, but now the head of Victory Programs has told the Boston Globe editorial board that that plan looks like a dead deal. Would you support jumpstarting those plans to turn that hotel into transitional housing?
Well, I think through the community engagement process, it was made clear that this would be a challenge. There was a successful model in that same hotel, but one thing we know we need to do is decentralize services here. They're licensed by the state, and we need more across the Commonwealth. And fortunately, the governor has made some investments now so that we will see some more programming across the state and not just here in Boston. But even in our city, we know addiction knows no boundaries. And so we need to do more to have treatment and services in other parts of our city and not just in one area.
Okay. I'm going to have to stop us there. That is Acting Boston Mayor and Mayoral Candidate Kim Janey. Mayor Janey, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity to connect.
WBUR and Radio Boston will join WCVB, the Boston Globe, and the McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston to bring you a debate among the major candidates on Thursday, September 9th. 4 years we have been talking about the neighborhood around Massachusetts Avenue and Malnia Cass Boulevard. WBUR's Deborah Becker has done extensive reporting on the neighborhood and spent some time there earlier this week. Deb, what'd you see?
Well, it's very sad. I'll start by saying that. There are streets lined with tents where people are living. I saw many people actively using drugs or nodding off, and seemingly people of all ages, races, genders, people in wheelchairs. I would say that it was quieter this week than when I visited the neighborhood earlier this month in the early morning hours. In the morning when I was there for a story, I saw many more people crowded in the streets, laying in sidewalks, people selling cigarettes, especially menthol cigarettes, which you can't legally buy in Massachusetts, people selling drugs. There's a lot of trash, human excrement. It's not a pleasant place to be.
So remind us, Deb, about the confluence that has come to Mass and Cass.
Well, the area is described as sort of the epicenter of the opioid epidemic in Massachusetts. There are several addiction treatment programs, homeless shelters, Boston Medical Center, and all of those services really are within blocks of each other. So people come to the area for services, and they have for a long time, but I think what's changed is that more people stay there. Some human services providers and business leaders estimate there are several hundred people right now living on the streets of Mass Cass.
Did you talk to people in the neighborhood? And if so, what did you hear?
I did. A lot of people say they don't know what the solution is, but they feel that it's just not sustainable. More and more people piling into the area and really no services for them, and people are getting hurt. There's violence. I spoke with business owners, human services providers, and the sheriff of the Suffolk County Jail and House of Corrections, Steve Tompkins. Here's Sheriff Tompkins talking about what he thinks is going on there, describing the area, and of course, his jail in the neighborhood.
It's getting worse every day. It's no longer just an open-air drug market, which it is. People are not just like fornicating and defecating there, which they do, but there has been an element of human trafficking that has been introduced, I'm told. I don't see how this gets better by itself. And so it needs the intervention of community activists, business folk, the state, and the city.
And the sheriff was a member of the city's Mass Cass Task Force, which Acting Mayor Janey just referred to. But the sheriff said the task force has been ineffective. And Acting Mayor Janey did say there needs to be a revamping of that group. Sheriff Tompkins is asking for a whole new task force to be formed. He thinks there should be a smaller group to try to come up with solutions.
So, Deb, 15 seconds left. Your biggest takeaway?
I would say, you know, I've been doing stories about this area for years, and there are more people there than I've ever seen. And, you know, many people say the crowds there are largely due to the closing of the Long Island Bridge in 2014. Many services were there, and I don't know if they're going to come back, but I think a concerted effort is needed to come up with a bold plan to help the people living and working in the Mass Cass area and on the streets.
We'll look forward to following this more with you. WBUR's Deborah Becker. Thanks, Deb.
You're welcome.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Walter Wuthman, Amanda Beland, and Cynthia Betubiza. We had help from Allie Audette. It's her last day today. Best wishes, Allie. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.